Okay, welcome back to the podcast. This is episode number 143 with my guest, Mike Rosen. Michael Rosen is the percussion professor at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music in Ohio. He taught Adam Slewinski, one of the members of SO, my teacher at Yale, Robert Van Cise. He is really good friends with my undergrad teacher, Dr. Larry Snyder, and he is a wealth of knowledge on the history of marimba repertoire, the sort of growth of contemporary music and marimba repertoire in the United States. And he's an amazing cook. He has a pizza oven in his backyard. So I enjoyed talking with Mike Rosen, and I hope you enjoy this too. All right. Talk to you soon. Take care.
But Mike Rosen, I appreciate you doing this. You know, we don't know each other that well, but I know a lot of people really well who you know really well. I've always wanted to get to, wanted to talk with you. I've spoken at length with Larry Snyder, who is a friend of yours, and I work in SO Percussion with one of your former students, Adam. Whether you want to claim him or not is another story. But with Adam Slewinski, and I'm curious. I don't have an agenda for the podcast other than just to get to know you a little bit better. But I'm curious if you'd be willing to sort of clue me in a little bit as to what got you into percussion before you even met Larry or Adam or any of your, you know, Bob Van Cise or any of the people that I came in contact with. What got you into percussion?
Sure. Well, first of all, it is great to be here with you guys. I've appreciated and really admired what you guys have done, and so it's really fabulous.
Well, thank
you. And it's good to be with you and get to know you better, too. I don't know. Let me see. You sure wanted to know what got me into percussion?
Well, you teach at Oberlin right now, correct?
You know, like any junior high school kid, I teach at Oberlin Conservatory. I've been here since 1972. So I've been here for a while. It seems to me that as I remember it, I was in the choir in elementary school. Okay, and I remember this event. We went to junior high school. And in junior high school, I was called out of the classroom by the choir director, who had heard that I was in the choir in elementary school. And he called me in to audition, or he wanted to hear me sing, whatever. You know, I was only, what, how old are you? 9, 10, 11, something like that?
Yeah.
So I left the classroom. Oh, it's a big deal, you know, the classroom in the middle of the day while all the classes are going on, you know, and I'm in the hallway all by myself. So I'm walking down the hall, and I pass by the band room. And couldn't help but look in because I heard the band and heard drummers in the back playing. And I looked in, I said, ooh, that's more interesting than singing. So that was the beginning of it all. And I never went to the choir room. I just went in the band room and said, I want drum lessons. And that's how it started. Simple as that.
Who was your teacher?
Serendipitous. You know, in elementary school or in junior high school, I don't remember. I think it was just a band teacher there. Things didn't really get started for me seriously until I went to high school. And I had lessons with a big band drummer who was actually a relative of mine who played like Buddy Rich. And I'm embarrassed to say that I can't remember his name. And then I played in the band and got very interested in vibraphone and marimba because I had played piano for a long time. That was really where I started with piano. And I figured, well, you know, everybody plays the drums, but not many people play the vibes. So I got a vibraphone instead of a drum set for my first thing. And I took lessons when I was in high school with a vibraphone player whose name was Vince Montana.
Whoa.
Have you ever heard that name?
No, I haven't, but that sounds like a character out of a Scarface movie.
Never heard that name, right? Well, it was very interesting. because many, many years later, you know, 30 years later, I was in California at the PAS convention when it was in California then. I don't remember the date. And I producer of records, and then he has since died. But he started me with, believe it or not.
Was the name Vince Montana? Did I hear that right?
Vince Montana.
And he was a member of the Scarface? Was he on the Scarface movie? Is that...
I don't know what he was, but I just remember he used to come to my house, give me lessons. And I lived up in Northeast Philadelphia at the time. Mm-hmm. And he had to take a subway and a bus. And he probably got $5 an hour, a lesson, may guess, 10, maybe 10. $10 a lesson. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about it was that he taught me Musser grip, format Musser grip.
Okay.
Now, remember now, this is well before Gary Burton, with his Gary Burton grip. Mm-hmm. Some people were using cross grip, but I had no idea. That was also before the days of the comeback of George Hamilton Green.
Mm. So remind me the year. This, what year was this where you were being taught this grip?
I'm embarrassed to tell you, it was probably 1957, 8, 9.
And what were the conversations just amongst your friends in the percussion community when these grips were coming out? Like, were you all suspicious? Were you like, oh, that's stupid, nobody will ever use it? Like, what was the sort of chatter around the water cooler about the four mallet grips?
Josh, there was no chatter. Talking. who had a community? There was no percussion community.
Well, there were four of you at least, right? Like,
it's interesting. You're projecting what it is now.
Yeah,
communication. I don't know. He just said, hold the sticks like this. I took them and dropped them and then picked them up again and didn't drop them. And then that was it. Interesting that later on, Charlie Owen did the same grip. Now, the big difference, of course, is that the hands are turned over a little bit more than the Stevens grip. Mm-hmm. Stevens grip, the thumbs tend to be turned up,
right,
and the arm is used a little more stiffly, whereas with this grip, it's a little bit more throwing, using the weight of the stick and the weight of your arm, you know, to make a big sound like on piano. And that's what I teach my students. That's what I go for. Even if they're playing Stevens grip, I try to make sure that they also give me a big fat sound, not unlike a pianist. If you think about a pianist sitting at the piano and then their teacher tells them to get a bigger sound, they don't just jab with their wrists.
Right, right.
They use their entire body. Do you play piano?
No, I don't, but I play drum set. I play steel drum. It's like, it makes total sense what you're saying. I mean, you don't just use your small motor muscles are generally not very useful in loud sounds. I mean, like.
It tends to be sharp. Mm-hmm. It tends to be, not have a full sound. as a matter of fact, if you see some great pianists, they'll actually almost jump off their seat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen that. That's sort of the idea. So with the back of the palms up, you can see me, but of course we can't on the podcast. But you know, this way instead of this way.
Right, right. I sort of ask in jest about the, like, what was the chatter around the water cooler, because I think when I was a freshman in college. I was in high school when I got introduced to the four mallet grip, and Method of Movement had just come out. And so there was a method that everybody was then, you could run everything through. And I started that way. And then as I got into college and started playing the music of Steve Reich, and I never was a good Mermaid player anyway. So I never felt like I had much use for the sort of like very tiny muscle movements. And then I joined So, where I almost play exclusively Steve Reich on marimba, and that's all just this. And so my grip slowly morphed from the, like, you're only going to use your thumb and your forefinger to, why don't I use my shoulder, you know, like in my elbow, because those are just as important.
You won't get as tired either.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can't play music for 18 musicians with page 2 of Method of Movement. Like, that's just not.
Exactly. It's just it's a whole different thing.
Right.
But it's really funny that, you know, what, cross grip, Musser grip, obviously no Stevens grip. We were dumb then. Who did we know? There was nothing. We were just there, and the guy said, "Do this," you do this.
Well, you're solving problems. I mean, this is. I've been talking with a few folks who knew Alan Abel really well, and I've always been struck. I mean, he just passed away a couple weeks ago, but I've always been struck, and I've only crossed paths with him like twice, maybe. At like the problems, the solutions to his problems weren't like, you know, divined from the heavens. It was like, my castanets need to be louder. Why don't I hold four and hit up four others? Like, it's not rocket science. It makes total sense when you see it. It's just he solved a problem. And I feel like you all were sort of you were all at the tip of the spear of solving the four mallet problem. And it's been codified over time. But it's interesting for me to hear people clock how that stuff was happening.
Yeah, it just happened. And then I played four mallets. I played in marimba. I played in clubs. Mm-hmm. I had a job in Asbury Park at a little hotel called the Belmar Hotel. Mm-hmm. And I, at night, I would go into town in Asbury Park and play in these bars. That's all they were. And I would play with a organ trio.
Whoa.
There was a drummer there who was playing with me, and his name was Rashid Ali.
Shut your mouth. Rashid Ali? Like the Rashid Ali.
This was 1961 or two.
Oh, my God.
And he was obviously way before he got with Coltrane.
Right.
And I just remember playing vibes and doing stuff, jazz. And then he was playing drums. And then he said, "I'm going to go get a drink. You play for me." So I went back to his drum set. Mm-hmm. And he played this Gretsch, you know. A lot of African-American guys played these Gretsch drum sets, which sounded great. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting down, and I couldn't make them sound like anything. It sounded like crap. I just could not get a sound out of it. Mm. And then he came back, and he played it, and it sounded great.
Yeah.
So it was really a fascinating thing for me about, although later on I sort of put it together that it ain't the drums, it's how you play them.
Yeah.
You know, some often.
Yeah. Yeah. Often. Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's any musician who I'm like, no, it really depends on the instrument. Like really good ones have and I'm finding this the older I get, I'm only 40, but mm-hmm. I still feel like I know it's like, no, I know what I'm going to sound like before I make a sound now, yeah. About 70% of the time. And when I was in college, it used to be 10% of the time. And I know when I'm 60, it's going to be a little better, but.
Well, then again, don't forget. We have to realize that sometimes if you hear Alan Abel play or Rich Wiener play or any of the guys who are playing now in the orchestras, and they just sound beautiful, mm-hmm. They have good equipment.
Yeah.
And it's often good equipment that makes you sound better. Of course, you have to play it well, and you have to get a good sound, and you have to have good control, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all of the parameters, but the fact is that they pick the best instruments because they have good ears and they know what they want it to sound like, whether it's Chicago or Boston or Philly.
Right. I often look at my students sometimes when they try to play something and it's like, and the instrument sounds bad and they mess up and they stop and they look at the instrument like they're Bill Buckner looking at their glove, you know, and it's like, it wasn't the glove. This time it wasn't the glove, you know.
That with my students, and they really hate me for it. But we'll play cymbals.
Yeah.
And we're working on cymbals. And they'll play a couple crashes, and they don't sound good at all. And I take it away, and I say, "I think you broke it. Let me see. I think it's broken." And then I'll play a crash, and they say, "Oh, no, it's okay. It's not broken." And yeah. they get so mad when I do that.
Well, you know, one of the other reasons I
– is that it's a combination of the equipment and how you play it, obviously. You've discovered that over the years, and every student will if they've got a good ear.
Yeah, I'm getting better at it. I wouldn't say I think my batting average is probably about 250, so I'm like Mark McGuire maybe. You know, I might go in the Hall of Fame, but I still feel like I'm trying to get that batting average up more and more as I go. And as a touring – I mean, the thing that I am jealous of orchestra musicians like Alan Abel or Rich Wiener is that they by and large have the same snare drum their whole life. And when I go on tour with So Percussion and I walk in a room, I have no idea what Lion's Roar is going to be sitting there. Yeah. So, you know, how we all have to skin those cats over our careers is a pretty relative process. But I'm curious for you, one of the reasons I really wanted to talk with you is that you were sort of patient zero, or one of the patients zero for our lineage. And in terms of bringing Keiko Abe to the United States and exposing students to vast amounts of repertoire that we had no idea, you know, even existed. And I'm curious if you'd be willing to talk a little bit about your early career teaching and sort of what your mindset was as you were starting to bring musicians from like Keiko and other folks over to the States to talk and to teach.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I was in the Milwaukee Symphony. And I was wanted to move up like any person. Mm-hmm. I remember I got into the Milwaukee Symphony. Believe it or not, there were 16 people auditioning, and I got the job. Mm. Well, everybody was nuts. 16 people, and you got the job?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. You know, obviously now it's 216 people. Mm-hmm. Probably more than half of them could do a good job. So anyway, I was in the Milwaukee Symphony, and I wanted to move up to Boston or to Cleveland or to Philadelphia. There was no opening in Philadelphia because that's when Charlie Owen, Hinger, Mickey Bookspan, and Alan Abel were in the orchestra, mm-hmm. and there was no opening there. So I figured I'm going to go to Oberlin and teach there, mm-hmm. and I'm just going to practice because I only had like 4 or 5 students when I started. Al Adi was a student of mine in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. He used to drive down from Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and took lessons with me. And then he had to go to college, and I suggested him going to Oberlin because Rich Wiener taught there. Mm-hmm. So he went there, and then when he graduated, was the year in 72, was the year I came there, and he is probably instrumental in me getting the job here at Oberlin. But the important thing was that I just wanted to come here, and all I wanted to do was practice for the next audition. Hmm. So I started practicing and teaching and realized, you know, I like this teaching business. I kind of liked it. Hmm. So really is the way I sort of switched from that performance career. I liked the idea of sort of being the one who picked the repertoire, and I was always very interested in contemporary music because I was at the University of Illinois when it was sort of the nascence of contemporary music for percussion and also just for music in general with Herbert Bruhn was there. Do you know that name?
Herbert. Oh, yeah, yeah. Were you there with Larry?
No. He was way after me.
Okay.
I was 64 or 5.
I got it. Okay, all right.
I think he was there in the 70s.
Oh, got it. Okay, all right.
If I'm not mistaken. Salvatore Martorano was there. You know that name too? Mm-hmm. Charles Hamm was there. Kenneth Gaburo. Larion Hiller. And it was really unbelievable. And I just loved it, playing that music and being there when it was there. But that was not my intent to play that music. There was just a few people who were doing that. So...
Was your interest in orchestra music... was there something... was there something that you loved about the music, or was it for me? I know, like, I love orchestra music, but there's just more career paths in the music world now than there were years ago. And I'm curious for you, like, were you psyched about orchestra music, or was it because that was the career path, that or teaching?
I loved the music. Hmm. I mean, I love jazz, and I wanted to play jazz vibes. That was what I wanted to do. And when I was this summer job that I was talking about in Belmar, New Jersey, mm-hmm. was an interesting thing for me because I would go to these gigs in the evening and play, and I realized that my solos were the same and that I was not inventive, and I couldn't really – it wasn't what I wanted it to be. So then I sort of went the other way to classical music, although at the same time when I was in high school and high school and beginning in college, I used to go into town and study theory – and composition with a guy by the name of Lenny Payton, who happened to have been McCoy Tyner's teacher also.
Oh, wow.
Because McCoy was from Philadelphia, and I used to see him come in and take lessons. And, you know, it was just a guy. I never knew who he was.
You sort of orbited some pretty important jazz musicians in your time. I mean, between Rashid Ali and McCoy Tyner, and like,
all I can say is, who knew?
Yeah,
I didn't know these guys very well. I mean, he came in, and that was it, you know. But I just remember playing there, and then getting into classical music, and then coming to study with Charlie Owen, and then coming to University of Illinois for the contemporary music. And it's one of the reasons I got the job here at Oberlin, because I could say that I was not just an orchestral musician, but that I was an all-around musician in terms of contemporary music, as well as orchestral music and a little bit of jazz. I played drum set, but I was not very good.
What was the scene around the contemporary, like, at least in the university systems? What was the sort of view on contemporary music?
At the time, the University of Illinois was very active. I mean, these guys were unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Do you know the name Kenneth Gaburo, by the way?
I don't know that name. I know, Larry has mentioned a whole circle of folks from Illinois, but I bet they might be a little after when you were there.
You really should look up his name. He was a man who was one of the first people, important people in spoken music.
Oh, okay.
Combining sounds, spoken sounds. And I remember, like, the hardest class I ever took was Specious Counterpoint with him. And it was horrible. I hated it. The hardest class I've ever taken. But anyway, I was there. And then here I came to to Oberlin. And I figured, if I'm not going to keep practicing Porgy and Bess and Lieutenant Kiji, I had taken a few auditions and didn't get them. Mm-hmm. I figured, what am I going to do? I play four mallet marimba, but there's no music. The only pieces were around was an organ concerto, an organ piece that was adapted for marimba. There was Musser pieces, but they weren't serious pieces. They were fun and good for use in getting technique, and I still use them these days with my students. But then I called up Tom Siwe, who I had studied with Jack McKenzie when I was at University of Illinois. They were both there. And I said to him, what's this teaching business about? You know? Tell me what's going on in the university, because there was hardly anybody. There were very few teachers teaching in universities percussion at the time.
Right.
It was mostly marching band, and that was about it. Indiana was one of the places, but that was not contemporary music. That was just classical. So he said to me, oh, by the way, I've got this great record by this marimba player whose name is Kiko Abe. So he gave me that. And I said, this is music. This was 1968, 69 when the pieces were written. And I was at Milwaukee in 72, 73 when I first got there, 72. So I said, I got to get this music. This is really fabulous. Well, obviously it wasn't published then. Mm-hmm. So I remember, it's kind of a funny situation. I remember being in my studio, and there was a Japanese student there who was a pianist, I think. And I asked her, I said, do you know Akira Miyoshi? And she said, I don't know him, but I've heard of him. Mm-hmm. I said, well, can you get his telephone number for me? I'm telling you, this is really what happened. So I said, well, I don't know. I said, well, do me a favor, call up your parents and tell your parents to look his number up in the telephone book. Swear to God. So she, a week later, she got a letter back from her parents. You know, no email. Come on, guys. No email. Maybe by telephone, but I got his telephone number. I remember sitting in my studio on the same phone I have right in my studio now, picking it up and dialing Japan. Hello, Mr. Miyoshi? Yes, this is Mike Rosen in Oberlin. Can you send me your music, please? Sure.
And that was that.
So he sent me handwritten copies of the originals of Tours 3 and Time. And a couple others.
Now, were there recordings of any of these out by this point yet?
Keiko had the recordings. Did you know about those recordings, the original recordings?
To be quite honest, no, I don't think I've heard the original recordings of them. I've heard Bob's and some other folks, but...
No, no, they're on 33s, the original ones.
Oh, okay.
It's just unbelievable. So, of course, I started learning the pieces, and of course, see, what people don't realize is that the last movement has five mallets. But the newest editions of the piece, they took out the five mallets and switched notes. But I remember saying, okay, what do I do now? So I was actually fortunate because I played Mustard Grip, and with Mustard Grip you can hold an extra mallet by crossing one of them underneath. So I put it under there and dropped it and put it back and dropped it and put it back. And finally, well, this works.
Yeah.
I was able to play the five mallet sections. And then after I played, the first performance was the University of Illinois, I think 73, when I premiered the Taurus III in America. And I remember there was one-handed rolls in it. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is absolute de rigueur now for any marimba player, one of the first techniques you learn. But then no one did it because there was no music for it. That was right. The only reason nobody did it.
Right.
When the music was written, then people said, oh, okay, I better do it.
Right.
Lee did later on with those pieces that he had written for himself.
Well, and that's usually the way the history of most instruments goes, right? Like, I mean, the Bach cello suites, there's a reason they get progressively harder. You know, it's like, I imagine Bach was learning about the cello and his friend was like, hey, you know, I tried this thing out. And then Bach's like, ooh, and then he goes home and writes a whole suite over it, you know, like.
Exactly right. And that's what we owe to composers, is to stretch us out a little bit, to expand our experience and make our technique better and then fit the music.
Well, Keiko is somebody, again, I never met Keiko. I didn't study with her. Jason Truding from SOBE studied with her for, I think, a month in Japan over a summer. But she is somebody in our field who is both a composer and a performer.
Right.
And an improviser, which for me is, it's interesting, like, that one of the early pioneers in our field that sort of blew up our repertoire sort of straddled a lot of different things. I mean, when you hear people play her, you know, Wind in the Bamboo Grove or some of her original works, it's not lost on me that sometimes they're playing it note for note, and they maybe don't know that Keiko was an improviser, and that when she plays those pieces, she's playing in it's like their lead sheets, sort of. And it's, I'm curious for you, how did you learn about that aspect of Keiko's playing and then adapt that into your teaching or your own playing?
Well, she, those are improvised pieces. Originally they were improvised. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, I think Keiko got a little tired of playing pieces written by composers. So she would do things like variations on on time. And then she would do things where she'd go around and she'd have us two people play it together and improvise on it. Not really, not following the music, but sort of using it as a basis for doing it.
Was this something that that like Miki was okay with? Like, did she talk with him about it, or?
That's a good question. I don't know. I imagine so.
I'm not a purist. I don't care one way or another, and I'm not going to get upset or anything at her. But it's interesting to me, like, to take, when I think of time for marimba, I definitely don't see that as a lead sheet sort of approach. You know, Wind in the Bamboo Grove or variations on Japanese children's song, I could maybe see that better. But
well, but think about it. Don't forget, time is a variations. It's variations.
That's true. So, that's true, yeah.
With the melody being in the bass line for a while, and then being at the top for a while, and then for it being in the middle of chords for a while.
Right.
I can point those places out to you.
No. Yeah. I mean, sorry. As you're saying it, I'm realizing the error in what I was. I mean, again, I'm recognizing my own ignorance of her music, but also, like, I studied with Bob on that piece, and at least the way Bob taught that piece for me was very much like, we're going to deal with marimba sound, but you're going to play every one of these damn notes right where Miki put them, and then we'll talk about futzing with the music later. And I think I never got to the futzing with music later part because I was never very good at marimba. So we didn't quite get there with that piece, but that's interesting.
No, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what I would say to my students too. And I don't have them improvise on it. It was her thing.
Yeah.
She is an extraordinary person. And she came to our house several times when she came. And eventually I wanted to find, to get her here to play the music. And this was 1975, maybe 76.
So there were 2 years between when you did the premiere of Taurus 3 and when Keiko came here.
Then I did. I also premiered them in Europe, those pieces in Germany.
Before 75?
Yeah, no, I think it was around the 76 or so, 77. I'm not sure exactly when. Okay. I had a sabbatical when I went over there and I taught.
Got it.
But I just remember nobody played four mallets at the time. I mean, that's probably hard for you to realize because there was there's so much proliferation of music now that it's staggering how much is being written.
Yeah.
And how it's being stretched. I remember doing clinics over there in the Zweling Conservatory in Holland and sort of warming up and playing four mallets and doing some four mallet stuff like anybody would noodle now. You know, they're noodling with four mallets and the students coming in and sort of with their mouth agape,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking and going, what is that? Now, of course, within 2 years, Holland, Sweden, France, maybe less so France, Sweden, Denmark, boom, they had the four mallet thing and it was unbelievable and they did it. So it was fun to introduce it, but they just went crazy with it and just did it fabulously and like they do now.
Yeah.
It became our technique, not unlike piano happened after Liszt.
Right.
You know, I'm not calling myself a Liszt, but it was at the very beginning. And then, of course, Lee and Gordon took over and became the second wave generation of playing that.
Well, what was it you learned when Keiko came in 75? What was it in that sort of first, I don't know, I'm always very interested in the very first drop in the bucket of a situation. And with Keiko coming here teaching for the first time, the minute she walks in the room and starts doing her thing.
Yeah.
For you as an observer, what was some of the, like, did you have any moments where you were sitting there going like, oh my God, I'm witnessing something. Like this is, I don't know where this is headed, but this is important and I don't know why. Like for you, what were some of those revelations watching her?
Revelations were that I realized how heavy she played.
Oh, she was
a very heavy player. Even up until recently, I conducted her several years ago in Geneva when we did a concert together and I conducted it when she did Prism. And just unbelievable at a later age when she was getting a little older, she still played unbelievably heavy with heavy mallets on an instrument that could take it, the Yamaha instrument. You really had to have some weight, and she just used her whole body, and I remember that. I also remember having a very strange time, sense of time, very strange. We did a little ragtime, and I would play snare drum, little brushes on snare drum, ding, dick, ding, dick, ding. And she was playing a little ragtime thing, and it was very hard to stay with her because I just remember that being a little, how shall I say, odd. That happened also with when she and I and Mickey Booksband and Arnie Lang did the first performance of Marimba Spirituals. Which I think it was in 1996, if I'm not mistaken, in Ann Arbor. And, you know, the beginning, you know, the piece, I'm sure everybody does. It became a standard. And all of a sudden, she stops playing. And then the drum comes in, the shimmy daiko comes in and goes, dak, 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 and then she jumps on it and starts playing it. Well, we only had one rehearsal and she was rather far away from us. And I remember, it fell apart. We just couldn't stay together. I said, what is going on here? We're never going to get this together. So Mickey was playing that part. And I looked over at Mickey. I said, Mick, just play loud and play steady. And she will grab us because she's a fabulous musician and she will jump onto us. And sure enough, that's what he did. Mickey came to that spot and just, and she came in with her little thing, bah, 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 and it just went fabulously for the whole piece. But that's the revelation that I really got from her. I loved her tone, but she played very heavy. And I'll tell you one of the things that happened. She brought her tuner with her, whose name was Mr. Suzuki. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Suzuki tuned her instruments for her and also set them up. Now, as I remember, I don't think she brought an instrument with her then. I don't think that she brought one. She just played on my King George. Mm-hmm. So she played on my King George. Sounded great. She loved it. Mr. Suzuki loved it.
Which is a Deegan instrument, and it right? And they're not built the same way Yamaha. They're not necessarily built for playing with your whole body with very heavy mallets.
Well,
am I wrong?
Well, it's a different instrument. It's tuned differently. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you about that in that next step in a little while. But meanwhile, yeah, she's played the concert. And if you can remember, you've played Torch 3. What happens at the end? The last note.
I have not played Torch 3.
No, in time.
Oh, in time?
Yeah, what happens?
Is it the ba-bom-bom, that
yeah.
low C sharp?
And she cracked the bar. A C natural.
Vindicating students all over the world, making every student feel better about themselves.
No, not at all, because this was a My King George instrument, which is a vintage instrument. Well, Mr. Suzuki felt terrible. He took measurements of it and made another bar for me and sent me a bar.
Oh, wow.
Within a couple months. I still have the broken bar, of course, but the new bar also. And then I said to him, he was working for Yamaha, I said, I want you to make, he loved the sound of the King George also. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, I'd like you to make for me an instrument tuned the way the King George is tuned by Yamaha. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's a great idea. Why don't you? So he took measurements, he took acoustic tuning, mm-hmm. and he made an instrument and brought it to one of the PAS conventions. I don't remember where. He brought the bars, and we put it up on a Yamaha instrument. The other problem, of course, is the King George is only four mallets, whereas four octaves.
Yeah.
Everything nowadays needs five. Mm-hmm. But at the time, there wasn't that many pieces. Don't forget, Torch 3 and Time and even the Tanaka pieces are all for four mallets, four octaves. Mm-hmm. So he set it up, and we played it, and it didn't sound good. It sounded terrible. Ugh. And we figured out why. The King George is tuned to a weak minor third in the second octave, mm-hmm. not to a major third. Mm-hmm. Now, atoms are often tuned, the older atoms, I don't know if they are now, were tuned to a major third, and because of that reason, they sounded much better with groups in an ensemble, because the tuning is a little bit sharper, a little bit truer, mm-hmm. whereas the King George was warm and sounded great with other King George instruments like it did on the tour, you know, the King George tour, mm-hmm. And if other instruments get there, they sound great because the minor third is very warm and it's very strong. Mm. Now, Suzuki tuned it, and the minor third came out too strongly, and it sounded out of tune.
Oh, wow, okay.
Really terrible. He said the only way to fix this is by making the bars shorter. But Yamaha did not want to retool their entire instrument. Mm-hmm. So they wrapped up the bars, sent them back, and that was the end of the experiment in trying to get Yamaha to make tuning like King George instruments.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I've noticed the development of tuning in the sort of the polishing of the way instruments are tuned, talking to Bill Uhas, talking to Cliff Alexis about steel drums. And he talked to Bill Uhas a ton about how they tune glockenspiels and like how everybody sort of collaborates on that stuff is interesting to me. And getting on different, you know, an Adams compared to a Member One compared to a Corey. I remember playing one of the Bach cello suites, D minor. C minor. And I was playing it for our ear training teacher at Yale. She was a pianist, and she came down and she's like, this sounds awful. And I was like, what? I'm playing all the right notes. And she's like, no, take it up the octave. She's like, you're playing in major. That's all she kept saying. And I was like, no, I'm not playing in major. And she's like, I keep hearing E natural. It's because every time you play the low C, you hear the E 2.5 R, 2 octaves and a third up. And so I took it up the octave where the tuning systems are different, and you don't hear that prominent third anymore. And she's like, oh, so much better. Just play it there. And
I guess as you were playing it on an Adams.
It was an Adams, yeah.
That's exactly what I just said.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's something I think as students, you know, students listening to stuff, like if you think something sounds bad, don't assume it's any. It might be the instrument. It might, and just to go back to the Bill Buckner reference earlier, you know, it might actually be the instrument. Take it up or down the octave and see if that helps.
Well, for some reason, students always like, well, not for some reason, because it sounds warmer, to play Bach cello suites and even violin things an octave lower. Mm-hmm. And depending upon the instrument, Cori and Marimba 1 sound more similar than Adams. Now, I don't know about Adams today.
Yeah.
And I don't know about, what's the other, Marimba?
Marimba 1.
Marimba 1?
Yeah.
Marimba 1 is in California. What's the one that Lee Stevens has?
Malatec?
Malatec, right. They are differently also.
Right.
So it's really just a matter of taste. I prefer to my sound. I've always played on the King George, and my students love playing on that instrument. Mm-hmm. We play anything that has four mallets. They love playing on that instrument because you don't have to work at it. You just play it. And I used to use rather light sticks on the King George. And then when I got the Marimba 1, my mallets didn't work anymore.
I'm curious for another aspect of your life that I feel like is a big something that you talk a lot about, and I see you giving clinics on, is orchestral percussion. Mm-hmm. And I think in addition to Keiko Abe and the marimba, and sort of you being a sort of focal point for a lot of that rep early on, I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about how orchestral percussion, and knowing that Alan Able just passed away, and sort of reflecting on his influence in this world. I feel like orchestral percussion, even though I personally didn't do a lot of it, is one of the main reasons we all are doing what we are doing in a university setting at all. Whether or not we wish there would have been other musics in university settings to begin with, like ethnomusicology and all that stuff. But I feel like classical orchestral percussion has been a bedrock of our studies in the university settings for a long time. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit for folks who maybe don't understand how that even got started, or why, or who it was that was sort of forging the path. I wonder if you could talk about that for a second.
It's an interesting thing. I remember studying with Charlie Owen and hearing the Philadelphia Orchestra when I was a kid. I used to go to the Friday afternoon concerts at 2 o'clock and I would hear Charlie play the cymbals. And then I would run up on stage, literally run up on stage and grab those same cymbals that he just got done playing the last movement, I'd strike four, and I would hit them. And I remember saying, that Charlie would say, it's all about the ear. It's all about the sounds you make. It's all about getting the most beautiful sound on whatever you do. All right, fast forward, University of Illinois. Now I'm playing with these guys who are contemporary music players. And boy, are they fabulous. Improvising, setups. Remember, this is early, so there was not the pieces that we know. There was no Volans. There was no Zanakis. There was none of the pieces that are considered standard repertoire now. They played the stuff fabulously. But to my ear, they didn't get a good sound. It didn't seem to matter if it was a good-sounding woodblock or a good-sounding cymbal. It was more important that they got there, that they hit it. And I just said, you know, that's not my training.
Yeah.
My training is that every sound has got to be the best. It's not about whether you hit it. It's how you hit it. You pick a different mallet. You pick a different place on the woodblock. You pick a different woodblock. I found that to be very true. So that's what I tried to bring to contemporary music, and I try to bring with my students. And of course, I do it through orchestral literature. Mm. Also, I find that the study of orchestral literature makes you a better practicer. Mm. And that's the first semester at Oberlin is a lot of snare drum, as I think Adam may have told you already.
Yeah.
And it's really less about the actual snare drum, although obviously it is. as it is about how to practice, how to make this better. I try to tell my students, how do you make yourself better? What do you do to do it? And that's when they can take that lesson in orchestral literature and then put that into timpani, put it into mallets, put it into learning Xenakis, put it into any piece that you want to, always keeping in mind the sound concept that I learned from the Philadelphia Orchestra. I must admit, it's gotten much, much better. I go to PS conventions now, and people are playing with a much better sound. And I remember in the early days, it was rudimentary, to say the least. It didn't matter what kind of mallet you used on a tam-tam, as long as you played it in the right place. Mm-hmm. And I try to make sure that my students don't do that, but in fact, maybe go to more trouble by picking more mallets.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the pitfalls of being a contemporary percussionist, where, you know, playing new music a lot. There's music flying across your field of vision every day, and it's different, and you don't have a chance to sit with it much. And so you do make choices oftentimes, man, as you were saying, like, I'm just glad to be there on the woodblock, let alone I was like, oh my God, the number of times I say that. And I feel like I've climbed a mountain just because my stick hit the right woodblock. Yeah. You know, of course, that's how a lot of my life is. But when you have the chance to sit down, I mean, that's something with orchestral music, like, because you're playing a piece that's 150 years old, and there's a huge repertoire of recordings and baggage and history behind what mute people use on the bass drum for Mahler 3 or whatever, or Rite of Spring or whatever it is. You have a little bit more responsibility, I think, just by default. And not that you don't have responsibility with contemporary music, but you just can't get away with as much when you're standing, you know, back in the back of an orchestra.
No, you're absolutely right. And your point of view sometimes is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
The old forest for the trees kind of thing.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I just know that I try to get my students playing contemporary music to think in those terms. For example, we use all calf heads. Mm-hmm. And I remember going on tour with the percussion ensemble, and they were really bummed. You know, I got to play on these plastic heads, you know, and they really noticed the difference.
Yeah.
And after a while, they begin to really understand that sound concept. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
We recorded the James Wood piece. You know that piece, of course. Did you play it too?
Which one?
The Polyphonies?
No, we have not. Cloud Polyphonies? We haven't played that one.
No, that's because I say that because it was played at Yale.
Yeah, okay. Maybe that was way after my time.
Yeah. And the last movement calls for six players with 11 drums each. And they were all calf heads when we recorded it.
Whoa.
The recording's coming out very soon. Oberlin's doing the recording. It should be out very soon, within the next month or so. And the sound is just that it's a whole different idea. And that's the way students here, I try to get that across to them.
Yeah.
Also, the other kind of interesting thing for me in terms of the teaching, because you asked about the teaching business, is that since I'm the only teacher here, although there's Jamie Haddad teaches here and so does Billy Hart, but that's more of in the jazz field. There's a consistent sound concept. So that when I teach timpani and I teach snare drum, there's a similar sound concept that they can carry from one instrument to the other. Sometimes when there's more than one teacher teaching that thing, especially for young students,
mm-hmm.
I'm talking about, you know, first year, second year, third year students who don't really have a sound concept of their own, mm-hmm. and need mentoring. And sometimes if they're pulled by this teacher who says, no, get this sound, another teacher says, get that sound, it can be confusing and lead to not having an idea of what you want. I think that's great. That concept is great for grad school.
Yeah.
After a student has they've got some idea of what they want to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, what is something for you? How long have you been you've been teaching now since 1972? So almost, what, 48 years? Am I doing the math right?
Yeah, that's good. I don't like when you say
Sorry. You've been teaching at Oberlin for about 13 years. Mm-hmm. I'm curious for you, what are some things that after 38 years where you're like, wow, this never changes. This is always the same with every incoming batch of students. And then here's some things over the 38 years, like, wow, this is really different now than it was, just the way students are seeing or digesting music or ideas or concepts or taking advice, taking criticism, not taking it. Like, what are some things that you've clocked as a teacher?
Let me see. What I have noticed is that students tend to be a little bit better. Why are they better? Because the students that I taught, Larry taught, Alan taught, any of those people, are now giving them the same pieces that I gave them in college. Mm. They're giving it to high school kids.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, they seem like they're playing better. The problem I find sometimes is they're sometimes playing pieces that they're not ready to play. Because they go on YouTube and they say, ooh, cool piece. I want to play that piece. And then they end up not being ready to play it.
Yeah, you're like a senior in high school, and you're like, I like autumn, and I love islands. Therefore, I would love autumn islands. You know, like it's like, oh, hold up a second, that you might be more ready for reflections on the nature, or not even that, like yell after the rain or something.
You're absolutely right, and so it's that progression has sort of been made stretto, made closer, mm-hmm. Because the students are doing the pieces that I gave them to. Where in fact they should be. I remember I did not a master class, but a jury in Lyon one time, and the students spent the whole year playing one piece, mm-hmm. literally, and then they would play it for a jury. And I would say, I would ask them, what else did the kids do? And they said, oh, nothing. They just worked on this piece. I said, well, he doesn't have the technique to play it. Mm-hmm. It's way above both technique and emotionally. Above his class, yeah. He just isn't ready, and that was my comment mostly.
Well, not to mention too, is the music economy in Lyon such that somebody could just learn one piece and survive for the rest of their life? That also strikes me as you're not preparing them for the real world.
This was a little bit a while ago, but it was also students, who were
sure
maybe freshmen or sophomore, and I remember them being sophomore and freshmen, just picking pieces or given pieces that were above them and they weren't ready to do.
Well, this is something I feel like, I don't know if this was teaching of yours that you did with Bob and it stuck with him, but he was always very adamant about, he would rather, like, I remember my first semester at Yale, I was terrible at timpani and I auditioned with Hochreiner 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. And that was my audition at Yale. I mean, there were other things I tried to make up for my lack of timpani skills in other ways. But he's like, okay, cool. Next week, you are going to do the first 30 etudes of Hochreiner number one. And I was like, okay, cool. And it was like, these are easy. And he's like, no, they're not. You're not making a good sound. And I was like, oh, okay. And then we did like the first 8 Gordon Stout etudes. And then we did all of the Bart Cortier etudes out of the marimba thing. And it was like, I was like, Bob, when am I going to play Time for Marimba? He's like, when you can play Bart Cortier's, Going for a Walk with Granddad. Like that's when, and he was always giving me way too much rep, but it was easy. And then once I could slay all of that, then it was like we bumped it up to the next level. And he was very methodical about that. And now in hindsight, as a 40-year-old, I'm very grateful because it's helped.
That's what it's about. I mean, it's not about coming in as a freshman and playing Reynolds or Thomas. It's about being able to do it and being ready to do it. The best thing that I can do for a student, I think, I've always thought this way, is give them the tools that they can do and then make myself obsolete.
Yeah.
If I just give the kid Tours 3 or whatever, Merlin, and say, here, just go learn it, they're going to come to me and ask me about it. And now the next piece that they're going to want to do, they're going to call me on the phone and say, well, how do I do this one? Mm-hmm. And now how do I do the next one? Whereas if we give them the fundamentals that work for them, that worked in music in general, they'll always have it. So you ask the question about the freshman. Well, sometimes the freshmen come in and they're ready to do all sorts of wild things and they want to do all sorts of things that they've seen on YouTube and on Vic Firth videos. And I say, we're going back, kid. You got to have good technique first. And I've never had a student ever And I've had lots of students who are doing very well in the field. Adam among them, Ross Carr, Matt Duvall, don't forget Bob Van Sice, and do you know Matt Cook?
No, not personally.
He's in a percussion group out in California. Anyway, the point is they've never said to me, boy, I wish we hadn't done snare drum.
Yeah.
I mean, boy, am I so glad we did that.
Yeah, Adam says that quite frequently.
Yeah, I'm just glad we did that, and now I can move on. And well, that,
and that, I was just
how they've changed, how students changed. In some ways, not at all, because they got to go right back. The other thing we realize, I'm sure you're beginning to realize this too, as a teacher yourself, when they come in as freshmen, they're kids. They're very young, mm-hmm. you know, and sometimes full of themselves, or sometimes the opposite, very insecure. And as a teacher and as a mentor, that's what we do for them. We make them people. And when they graduate, it's amazing to me. I'm sure you've seen that happen where you've taught after 4 years. Oh my gosh, we got a person here.
Well, I'll say, for me, I'm learning about myself as a teacher. And I kind of just want to ask you just selfishly, like, I'm at this point right now where I feel like I know enough to be dangerous. I have enough students in my past that are doing things and are like, okay, that worked. And of course I have students where I'm like, okay, that didn't go the way I thought. I've learned from that, right? Uh-huh. But now I'm in this point where it's just like, I say things and now students are like, nope, you're wrong. And I'm like, wait a minute, you have no idea. Like you don't, I'm personally having moments of like deep insecurity. It's like, well, maybe they're right. And I'm like, why am I in my head about what a 19-year-old thinks about how I'm teaching them how to play the steel drums? I know more about this than you. But that's not a helpful thing to say as a teacher to your student, to their face. Like, and I'm curious for you, how did you, when did you get to the point where you just stopped caring what they said to you and like your ego was able to let that stuff slide off? Or did it ever happen for you?
That's a good question. Let me think about it. I've only had one or two students who did that to me. One student I remember early on, I was teaching. It was a woman, as a matter of fact. And I was teaching her. And she said, well, Vic Firth doesn't do it this way. And I want to do it the Vic Firth way. So I said to her, well, you have to go study with Vic Firth. Mm-hmm. I can only teach what I teach. And I would say, don't shake my tree if you don't want my apples. You don't want my apples, don't shake my tree.
That's great. I'm going to use that if that's okay. I'm going to steal that.
Go ahead, it's yours. If you don't want my apples, don't shake my tree. So the whole idea was study with him. And so I never really had that problem of fighting that. And if a student didn't do it, maybe we didn't get along and they would leave and I would encourage them to leave because I'm not the teacher for them.
Yeah.
That's what you have to realize as a teacher is that you are not perfect for every single student. And you have to realize how can I alter, tweak what I want to get across
right.
to various students, which is actually for me kind of fun. For me, it's sort of like I have a dog, a nice big Bernese Mountain Dog, and I teach him tricks. And for me, it's not different than teaching a student in a certain way. Mm-hmm. You say to yourself, why in the world would a big dog like that want to roll over? There's no reason that he wants to do that. And I say to myself, how can I make him want to do that? Okay, it's sort of the same thing with teaching. How can you make the student seem as though it's a good idea for them to do it this way or play it this way or choose this piece or be ready for something? Mm. So it's about the psychology of teaching, not so much as what you teach.
Well, those are very – that's very sage advice, and it's – I'm going to log the sort of apples in my tree sort of thing in my brain. I mean it's admittedly it's my insecurity. Like I want to be right, and I want to be right for them. Like I want them to take my advice and be better versions of themselves. But also I need to acknowledge that, you know, like you said, not every piece of advice I give is going to work for every student. So I shouldn't take it personally when they're like, no, that doesn't work.
Well, not every – not every student is good for you.
Right.
Don't forget, it's an important thing to know. Think about the good teachers that you know, right? All the really good teachers. They have good students. Mm-hmm. Good teachers have good students.
That's true. It goes both ways. Well, let me pivot just before we wrap up. Something non-musical related, but something that I've always admired about you from afar, and that I've tried to emulate in my own life, and I've been doing it recently, and I'm learning how to make grandma pizza. And I don't have a brick oven in my backyard. I didn't build it myself, and I have crappy baking sheets, but my friend from Italy has taught me how to make a focaccia-style, grandma-style pizza dough, and I'm getting quite good at it. And mainly because people have asked me, like, what do you do outside of music? What's your hobbies? And I'm like, I don't have any. And now I feel like – and you are someone who's been sort of mildly, maybe is a good word, obsessed with food. Yeah. And Larry has told me about it. I talked to Adam yesterday. And I said, hey, I'm talking to Michael Rosen tomorrow. He's like, ask him about food. He's probably way smarter about food than he is about Kiji. And so I'm curious, like, what is it about food in your life? How did you get psyched about food, and why did you build a pizza oven in on your property?
Well, I've always been interested in food. It was interesting in my family at the time, men didn't cook. Mm-hmm. It was the woman who cooked, you know, when I was a kid. But my dad was a very avid cook, and he used to cook a lot. And I sort of saw it from them. I saw it from him and got interested in it and found it as a way to get some kudos from friends. We used to have jam sessions late into the middle of the night, and I would make waffles for everybody or something like that. So I just got more interested in it, more interested, and read more about it. And it just became an important part of my life. It's like a hobby, a person who is serious about photography, or a person who is serious about painting, mm-hmm. or, you know, name 100, stamp collecting, name 100 hobbies. And that's just sort of what it became. And it all became a way, I guess, for me to get a little kudos from friends and to also satisfy them. It's a very giving thing. I think cooking is a very giving thing. Mm-hmm. And it's not unlike percussion in many ways. Do you know that the instruments that are used in a kitchen is called the batterie de la cuisine? And of course, in French, percussion instruments are called the batterie. So, aha, there's a similarity there somehow.
Wow.
What do you put in your focaccia?
Well, it is dough, a little bit, dough, yeast, olive oil, salt. And I think that's it.
Does it tend to be a little bit firm or soft? When it's all finished,
it's crispy on the bottom, and then it gets softer as it goes to the top.
Are there lots of holes in it or not?
Not really. No, I mean it looks like focaccia. You'd recognize it as a focaccia style bread rather than a traditional pizza dough. But I wouldn't say, at least what I've only done two. It's not as spongy as I would say a typical focaccia you might see at like a cafe or something sitting on the.
What you do is you make your dough more wet. Mm. Put a little bit less flour in it, and it makes it a little bit harder to work. But that'll make it a little bit more bubbles. That's what ciabatta is. Have you ever noticed the holes in ciabatta?
Yeah.
Have you ever noticed that ciabatta doesn't look like a loaf of bread? It looks like a lump.
Yeah.
It's because it's not formed. It just sort of lays there and rises, and then it's got big holes in it.
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, the thing that I've always been terrified about being in the kitchen, and my wife is an amazing cook, and she's always like, I don't understand how you can walk on stage at Carnegie Hall in front of 3,000 people and play a piece by Steve Reich that no one's ever heard.
Yeah.
But when you get in a kitchen with a recipe and a timer, you absolutely melt down. Like, we almost got a divorce the other night, Mike, because we were arguing about, like, I was freaking out about pizza, you know, about my dough not rising. Uh-huh. She's like, you need to calm down. How are you this calm when you're in front of an audience? And it's been very fascinating. There's something about improvising in the kitchen. You do something wrong. There's chemical reactions, so you can't take it back. Once you put the water in the dough, you can't take the water out. And
you have more flour.
Right. But yes, yes. And so you have to adapt. And that's something in the kitchen for me. It's interesting just to acknowledge for myself that I'm very rigid and conservative in the kitchen. I have very little flexibility. I give myself very little flexibility, and I need to get better at that.
Well, think about improvising on percussion. Think about improvising in the kitchen. It's real. I very seldom, I don't follow recipes. I get ideas from recipe books. I'll see something and they say, aha, this is kind of an interesting thing. And then I know what the elements are. I know what the basic techniques are. Mm-hmm. When what goes in, how long things take to cook, how long each individual part takes to cook when you put it together. But this doesn't necessarily have to be peppers. Yeah. If the recipe says peppers.
Yeah, it's I'm only saying this just to say, like, I'm scared to branch out from my pizza right now. I'm getting good at that, and I don't want to have a failure right now. But just before we wrap up, what was the conversation like with your wife when you were like, I want to build a pizza oven? Was she like, I want a Mazda Miata? Now you go.
All for it.
Yeah?
She was all for it. What I should do is I can take a picture of it and send it to you.
I'd love to. I'd love that.
Yeah.
Well, I asked Larry Snyder. I remember him as a student. He came into the hallway one day and he had a piece of pizza, and it was something I think you guys had been hanging out the night before. And I said, well, what did you bring to the party? It seems like Mr. Rosen makes everything. He's like, and he just went to his desk and pulled out a bottle of bourbon.
Yeah.
He's like, this is what I make. This is what I make for our hangs.
He does a good job at it too.
Yeah. Well, Mike Rosen, I really, really, really am grateful for your time. And the door on my podcast is always open. I know we barely scratched the surface in terms of your history, but let alone the percussion history. And there's a lot of people out there who I think would be interested to hear more. So if you'd ever be willing to come back on and chat about other stuff, I would be more than happy to have you.
Okay. The only thing let me leave you with.
Please.
Is our place in sort of the history of percussion, and I appreciate that you're interested in that. And I just feel as though I'm standing on the shoulders of Charlie Owen and Alan Abel and Mickey Bookspan, and they stood on the shoulders of Podemski and Schwar in the Philadelphia Orchestra, mm-hmm. All of those people, and that you guys are standing on our shoulders. And then you'll just take it to new places. I think that our generation, Rich Wiener, and my generation has taken it to new places that Charlie Owen did, and that generation. And you guys are going to take it to a new place that we didn't take it. And percussion's in good hands. You guys are doing great, and it's fabulous that you care so much about it. And it's something that I appreciate very much.
Well, I right back at you, and I want to echo everything you just said. And the other sort of thing I want to toss in is that I think it's important to me to have folks like you on the podcast. I think students these days, when they hear about Mike Rosen, or they hear about Bob Ensize or Russ Hartenberger or Chris DeVinny or whoever these folks are, it's hard for folks, at least students, to identify with you. I'm seeing it with me. Folks have a hard time identifying with me as someone who used to be a student and used to be all the things they're doing. And I think it's important for them to understand that you were in a practice room staring at your hands being like, why can't I hold four mallets at some point, you know, in your life. And I want students to know that you were in the trenches at some point too. Yep. And we're all just walking on each other's footprints right now.
We all started with page 5 of Stick Control.
Yeah. That's true. All roads lead back to Stick Control. Well, Mike, thank you so much. Take care, stay safe and healthy. And I hope to talk with you again soon.
Sure. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All righty. Take care. Okay. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. This podcast was brought to you by Liquid Drum. LiquidDrum.com, down in Waco, Texas, run by Todd Meehan. Check him out. You won't regret it. Small World Coffee down in Princeton, New Jersey. 2 locations, Nassau and Witherspoon Street. You can check them out at smallworldcoffee.com. And finally, DunleavyPans.com. Kyle Dunleavy makes amazing steel drums down in near Philadelphia. Makes all the drums I play at NYU, Princeton, and personally in So Percussion. DunleavyPans.com. All right, hope you're all well. Talk to you soon. Bye.